All right, this morning we're continuing our study of the miracles of Jesus. And we're studying what I think is a remarkable and very interesting miracle, that the coin in the fish's mouth. And if you didn't get it, a question sheet, I have some of those here. And there's also some on the back table as you enter the building. And I've always, I think from the first time I read this miracle, was very intrigued by it. Because it's not like any of the other miracles we see in the Gospels at all. And I was excited to actually be teaching on it. And, you know, since I'm the one kind of scheduling the teaching, I got to give it to me myself to do. But when I did that, I had no idea what I was going to say. I had no idea what I was going to discover as I studied. And I really learned a number of things. But this miracle is unique in a number of ways. It is peculiar to the book of Matthew. That doesn't make it unique. There are three or four other miracles, I think, that are peculiar to the book of Matthew. But why does Matthew seem an appropriate person to be relating this miracle to us?
Because he was Jewish or Hebrew?
Well, that helps, yes. He was Jewish or Hebrew. What was his occupation? Yeah, he was a tax collector. So, you know, this miracle that has to do with the paying of a tax certainly is appropriate for Matthew to relate to us. So, but this miracle is no one is interesting. No one was healed from any disease. No one was raised from the dead. No demons were cast out. No disciples were saved from impending danger. No one who was hungry was fed. How many people witnessed this miracle? One. Peter is the only person who witnessed this miracle. And what did he just recently confess about Jesus? Yeah, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Peter had just confessed that about Jesus. So do we think that this miracle of finding a coin in a fish's mouth really had any impression on Peter regarding his faith in Jesus Christ or the way he felt about Jesus? I mean, what had he already seen? So this miracle probably didn't have any impact one way or the other on Peter and his impression of who Jesus was. And there's one other interesting thing about this miracle. Do we have any evidence that it actually occurred? I mean, do we actually see the miracle taking place? No, the only thing we have is Jesus telling Peter that it's going to happen. Well, let's go ahead and read it. I should have done that before we started. But it's found in Matthew 17, 24 through 27. And it says, "And when they had come to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, 'Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax?' He said, 'Yes.' And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, 'What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or from strangers?' And upon his saying, 'From strangers,' Jesus said to him, 'Consequently, the sons are exempt. But lest we give them offense, go to the sea and throw in a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a stater. Take that and give it to them for you and for me.'" You and me, actually, the text actually says. But we don't actually see that miracle occurring. We just have Jesus telling Peter it's going to happen. Now, do any of us who have read about these other miracles and believe in Jesus Christ and believe the testimony of the gospel question whether the miracle actually took place or not? No, I don't think so. But, you know, there are some who try to explain this miracle away as a figure of speech. They say, well, really, Jesus wasn't literally telling Peter to go into the sea and cast in a hook and pull out a fish. He was just saying that the money's going to come easily. It's just going to come, so don't worry about it. Why bother? I mean, why would you want to explain away a miracle like this, for one thing? This one is probably, of many of the miracles, he could say, well, I guess, you know, it is a possibility that this could happen. It's very remote, but it's a possibility. And some try to explain it away on the basis that this miracle is really kind of trite. It's kind of beneath Jesus. It's more like a parlor trick or a magic trick. Why would Jesus do this? You know, we already discussed that Peter's the only witness, and it really didn't make it an impression on him one way or the other, I'm guessing. But he may have been the only eyewitness, but who else is being asked to believe that this miracle took place?
Us.
Yeah, all of us. We have a record of it. And John said, these things are written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you might have life in his name. So we're being asked to believe this miracle as well. And as we've talked about a number of times, our theme for this study is, who then is this? Who is this person who can do all these things? And I think this miracle teaches us who Jesus is in perhaps more ways than one as we study. And as is almost always the case with the accounts of these miracles, there's more to discuss than just the miracle itself, isn't there? You know, we have some context, we have some background, we have some things said that we kind of have to figure out what is being said, what is being taught. And so we have, first of all, the question of what this tax actually is that Peter is being questioned about, and we'll answer that. And I think it's very important to understand that. And then we have this question this question of Jesus' statement here to Peter of the sons being exempt to the kings from paying taxes, which I believe only makes sense if we first understand what this tax is, what it's really about. And then we have the miracle itself, which we're going to discuss in some detail, though there's not a lot to discuss about it, but it is very interesting. And as we work through the text here and through the questions on the sheet, and if you did not get it, then there's some on the back table there. I have some here. I can gladly get someone to hand to you as well. But we're going to just go through the text and the questions and answer the questions. And I think by the time, hopefully, that we're done with this class, then we'll have a better understanding of what takes place here in this passage. Well, first of all, let's look at the context. Where are Jesus and the disciples at this time? Question number one on your sheet.
Capernaum.
They're in Capernaum. And just prior to this, we discussed two miracles. I think it was a week ago Sunday, or maybe the Wednesday prior to our gospel meeting, Les taught the class on the Transfiguration, which is a very notable miracle in a sense of where Jesus is demonstrated to be really God himself, I think is the point, with power. And then we have the miracle that Hilton taught us Wednesday evening of the mute boy that was demon-possessed, that was cured. That was where the Father says, you know, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. That's the memorable thing of that miracle, I think, to most of us, that he wanted to believe, but he was struggling with that. So we have that. And now we have them showing up in Capernaum. What question is Peter asked here? And who is it that asked the question?
Well, obviously, I think they're either tax collectors or those from the temple.
Yeah, and I mean, what we're told in the text is it says those who collected the two drachma tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the two drachma tax?" Drachma and tax is hard to say together, but but I don't, and I think as we read the passage in Exodus, which I actually put on the sheet because I think it's very pertinent to what we're studying here. I think what we see is that this is these are not your run-of-the-mill tax collectors. These are likely some who served in the temple and collected, you know, the you could even say contributions in some sense. Like, you know, even like we have kind of a voluntary offering here at church. Now, I think this was a little bit more obligatory than that if you look at Exodus. But we'll talk about that as we get into it. Is there anything in their question that indicates they were not disciples of Jesus?
Well, I would take how he says, your teacher.
That was what I was thinking, your teacher. He's not our teacher.
That's right.
But your teacher. You know, does your teacher pay this tax? And, you know, this may just be, you know, when I was a kid, I had a paper route. And back in that day, I mean, you didn't pay stuff online. I think with paper routes, a lot of time you didn't even mail it in. You could have, but the way the subscription dues were collected for the paper route was you went door to door. Some of us probably had paper routes as well. You know, you get up at 4 a.m. to deliver papers, then you got to go out and ask people for money. And you just go door to door and you get that the subscription dues paid. Well, that's, you know, I think that's kind of that they were just going around saying, hey, you know, it's time to pay the temple tax. You know, are you paying? And that may have been their polite way of asking, you know, it's due, saying it's due. I do that to my customers all the time. I said, did you see the email with the bill that I sent you? Obviously, maybe 3 months ago, twice, 3 times now. You know, and just be polite. But or it could be they were trying to find a fault with Jesus as well. You know, here's another thing that we can get him on. He's not paying this tax. Well, what's Peter's answer?
Yes.
So one of two things, you know, either Peter knew he paid the tax and had seen him pay it. He's been with him a couple years now, I think, by this point, which would have been a couple opportunities to pay the tax. Or Peter just knew from Jesus' character and his concern about serving God and pleasing him that, yes, of course he pays this tax. It's something that's commanded. Let's see. Let's go on to the next question. How much is... I've got three questions here on number three. How much is 2 drachmas? How much is a stater? And how much is a shekel? Now, we see the 2 drachmas and the stater in this text. The shekel we'll see in the text in Exodus when we get to that. But how much is 2 drachmas? Drachma just sounds like a Jewish word, doesn't it? Drachma. Yeah, a drachma is 1 day's wage, so 2 drachmas, basically, is 2 days' wages. So it's not, you know, for somebody who's a working class person, that's a bit of money. All right, and so a drachma, or 2 drachmas is 2 days' wages. So how much is a stater, which is the coin that was found at 4 drachmas?
Yeah.
So that's just the exact amount to pay for the taxes for Peter and Jesus, pretty clear. Anybody look up how much a shekel was? Okay. A shekel basically is the Jewish equivalent of a Roman stater. It's 4 drachmas. So half a shekel is 2 drachmas. And we'll get to that in a second. So they're in Capernaum. Why might they be asking about this tax payment in this particular location? Why didn't they ask in Jerusalem or Gath or somewhere else?
Was that where Jesus was more or less centrally located?
Yeah. And I think that this is Peter's home. Peter's from Capernaum. Whose house is this? It doesn't say, but I think, you know, it says when they went into the house. It doesn't say a house, but and we know that Peter lived in Capernaum, his mother-in-law was there, and then when Jesus was there, I mean you can look at passages like Mark 2 and 1, and I think also Mark 9:33. You know, he was in the house in Mark 9:33, it says. And I think basically this is Peter's house, and Jesus stays there when they're in Capernaum. And this would have been an appropriate place for them to collect the tax. You know, here, Peter's home, let's go get him. You know, I finally see him. It's kind of like, you know, the bounty hunter looking for some. At least it's not quite to that extent. So I think that's why this is asked about here. So all right, so the big question is, what is this 2 drachma tax? And let's go ahead and just read Exodus 30, 11 through 16. And I, even in the question, you know, I did quite a bit of research on this. And this is really universally accepted to be what we're reading about in Exodus 30, 11 through 16. And that's on your sheet. If you have one, it's going to read off the sheet. The Lord also spoke to Moses, saying, when you take a census of the sons of Israel to number them, then each of them shall give a ransom for himself to the Lord. When you number them, that there may be no plague among them when you number them. This is what everyone who is numbered shall give, half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel is 20 gerahs. Half a shekel as a contribution to the Lord. Everyone who is numbered from 20 years old and over shall give the contribution to the Lord. The rich shall not pay more, and the poor shall not pay less than the half shekel when you give the contribution to the Lord to make atonement for yourselves. And you shall take the atonement money from the sons of Israel and shall give it for the service of the tent of meeting, that it may be a memorial for the sons of Israel before the Lord to make atonement for yourself. So all the evidence seems to suggest that this is what that 2 drachma tax is. It's a half shekel. equals two drachmas, when you do the math. So nobody seems to have even disagree with that. So it wasn't like the tax that Matthew collected for the Roman government. It was a tax collected for the upkeep of the tabernacle in Moses' day, which it seems to have extended to cover the upkeep of the temple. And it was collected probably by, servants of the temple, probably Levites who served the temple and did that. Who was required to pay this tax according to Exodus 30:14? All males 20 years old or over. Those basically who were susceptible to the draft, basically. And when it talks about the plague and stuff, when you numbered people, it was mainly saying, this is how strong my army is. And that's why David was actually got in trouble for numbering the people, because he was trying to say, look where our power is, when the power should have been where?
In God.
In God, not in the amount of people they had, but in God. So that's why that plague thing is mentioned there. According to verse 11 and 15, the question said, it should have said 12 and 15, to whom was this tax paid and for what purpose? According to Exodus 30, to whom was this tax paid?
To the Lord.
It was paid to the Lord. It says it three times. It says it in verse 12, and verse 15, and verse 16. And for what purpose? For atonement. For a ransom. Well, that's a pretty important thing to consider here. That this wasn't just a due. This was to redeem yourself. This was for atonement. And a ransom and atonement for themselves to be paid to the Lord himself. Why does somebody pay a ransom? Why would you pay a ransom?
To get someone back.
Yeah, but usually when we think of ransom, what do we think of? Being kidnapped. You pay a ransom to get somebody back from being kidnapped. Somebody who's kidnapped is being held bondage. Mm-hmm. They're taken captive. And you pay the ransom to release them from that bondage. So the children of Israel were supposed to be paying their own ransom, basically. They're saying, here, I owe you, here's my half shekel. Here's my two drachmas. You know? And did that free them from that? They had to do it every year, though. And the way when I was thinking about this, it's like paying the minimum balance due on your credit card. You've got this massive debt on your credit card, and you say, minimum due, $39.28. So you pay that. Does it really change your debt? What's it do? It keeps them from coming after you. It keeps the bill collectors from coming after you. You're just rolling the debt off until the next time you pay it, aren't you? And the debt's actually doing what, usually, if you're just paying that minimum balance? It's increasing. It's becoming more and more insurmountable. And people with severe credit card debt, they get in serious trouble. But this is talking spiritually. I mean, this is a debt that the children of Israel to pay every year, and to remind them, you owe something to the Lord here. Well, if I paid it, what do I have to pay it next year? Because you haven't paid it. You're just paying the minimum. You're just doing what you can do to stave off the bill collector. Which is the wears a black hood and is coming after you with a sickle in your mind. That's the thing. You're going to get it sooner or later. It's going to be due. And when the time comes to pay up, that's it. So I think that's what we have to recognize, that this debt was. It was for a ransom for themselves, paid directly to God himself. Well, you know what? That's what makes Jesus' statement here make sense, doesn't it? Because what does he say beginning in verse 26? So when Peter comes into the house, in Peter's house, I was thinking, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, which is interesting, did Jesus have to overhear the conversation to know what was happening? No, Jesus knew exactly what was going on. He may have overheard it, but he didn't have to hear it. He spoke to him first, saying, what do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or from strangers? And upon his saying, from strangers, Jesus said to him, consequently, the sons are exempt. So he's taking this physical nation, this physical kingdom, he's saying, if you've got a royal family here, and they're collecting taxes of the people, is he going to collect taxes from his son?
No.
They're part of the family. They don't have to pay tax. There's no debt owed there. I mean, that's the privilege of being in the king's family. You don't have to pay taxes. If I recall, I don't think our presidents have to pay taxes, do they? While they're in office. Or even maybe after that, I don't know. I mean, at least in, I don't know. I seem to remember reading something like that or hearing something like that, that I think on the money they receive while they're president, they don't, it doesn't matter. But when you take Exodus 30, 13 into consideration, what do you think is Jesus' point regarding earthly kings' sons being exempt from paying taxes? And Jesus is the Son of God. What's he saying? Did he need to atone for himself?
Nope.
Did he need to pay a ransom?
No.
He didn't have to do that. He's God's son. He didn't owe the money. So that's what he's saying here. I'm exempt from this. I'm the Son of God. Which Peter had just confessed in the previous chapter, by the way. I'm exempt from paying this tax. So, and Jesus was really exempt on two counts. Number one, he's the Son. And the other one is he had nothing to atone for. He didn't have his own sin to atone for. But I think Jesus is clearly claiming here in kind of a roundabout way that he is the Son of God again. He's exempt from paying this thing. He goes, and that's really what he says in this little parable he presents about the physical kingdom. So in verse 27, we're down to question 8 already, if you haven't figured that out. What specific reason did Jesus give Peter for paying this tax? Yeah, but lest we give them offense. And basically what he's saying is, listen, Peter, I'm the son. I don't really need to pay this tax, but just for appearance's sake, lest we offend them, do this. Let's talk about that for a minute. Jesus wasn't agreeing to pay this tax because of any debt he owed, but he was doing it not to give anyone the impression that he was guilty of wrongdoing. I think that's exactly what he's just saying, lest we give them offense, lest we give them something to say he doesn't pay the temple tax. Let's do this. He did not want to be condemned or accused of wrongdoing. And it's almost similar to what happened when John the Baptist was kind of refusing to baptize Jesus. What did John, Jesus came to him to be baptized, and John says, I have needs to be baptized of you. And what did Jesus say?
Permit this at this time. I think it's one of the Psalms that says, all things work for righteousness, or all things work for
good. Yeah, suffer it to be so at this time, so all righteousness may be fulfilled. Did Jesus need to be baptized? What was John's baptism for? The baptism of repentance for the remission. Jesus didn't need to repent. He didn't need to have his sins remitted. But in order for all righteousness to be fulfilled, he was baptized. And I think that's because that was what God was commanding the people to do through John. And he even says in Luke chapter 7 and verse 30 that the Pharisees and the lawyers rejected God's counsel for themselves, not being baptized by John. So Jesus did not want to give the impression that he was also rejecting God's counsel and being baptized. So I think those things kind of fit together. And sometimes, this is a really good lesson, that sometimes we have to sacrifice our own rights so as not to give offense to somebody else. And don't we see that throughout the scriptures? What about the Sermon on the Mount? If somebody strikes you on the other cheek, what do?
Turn down.
Yeah, according to the old law, you had the right to strike them back, right? I mean, that's your right. You can hit them back. Mm-hmm. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. They do that, you do it back. What's Jesus say? No. Don't do it. If somebody compels you to go for a mile,
go to.
Yeah, and the Romans had the legal right to do that. You could say, no, I did my mile. You can't make me go another mile, but just go too. Somebody asks you for your coat, give them your cloak also. And he says all these things for the sake of influence. You have the right not to do those things, but because you are a child of God, because you are a citizen of the kingdom, you do those for the sake of your influence. You act differently than the world. So you can influence the world. So you can be light in a dark world. Everybody can fight back. Everybody can shout back. Everybody can turn, not turn the other cheek. But who is it that doesn't do that? And for what reason? not because we're weak. Actually, it's because we're strong, because we fight that impulse to say, I'm not putting up with it. So we say, if my Lord can do it, then I can do it also for the sake of influence, for the sake of the person I'm speaking to. And, you know, in 1 Corinthians 6, it talks about, you know, why not allow yourself to be defrauded rather than go to court with your brother or sister? And it's saying, well, why are you, you know, fussing over these little insignificant things that are causing friction when you should just take it? You know, just say, forget about it. You know, for the sake of our relationship, I'm not going to go there with you. We're gonna get along no matter what it takes. As far as I'm concerned, that's really the, you know, Paul's thing of, as much as within you lies, be at peace with all men. And sometimes that means sacrificing our rights. And then, so Jesus says to Peter, but lest we give them offense, go to the sea and throw in a hook and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a staver, which is equal to
four
drachmas. Okay, question number 9, and you might think that's kind of a silly question, Rick, but let's discuss this for a second. How did that coin get in the fish's mouth? You know, and you say, well, that's just supposition, it really doesn't matter. And maybe it is. But there are two possibilities, it seems to me, how that coin got in the fish's mouth. What's one possibility? Yeah. Just miraculously appeared sometime before, after Peter caught it, or before Peter, it just miraculously appeared in his mouth, and Peter opened the mouth, and there's that stater in there. There's four drop of coin, whatever. So it just miraculously appeared. That is certainly an option. And it may be exactly what happened. What is the other possibility?
The fish did.
Yeah, well, the fish somewhere, sometime, got a coin in its mouth. May not have been able to go down and gull it, but maybe it just, you know, are fish, you know, are they attracted to shiny objects?
Sure.
Yeah, that's what lures are. You know, so it's easy to think that a fish would have got a coin in its mouth. And then sometime after that fish got the coin in its mouth, Peter just happened to throw a hook in at just the right time, catch the fish, reel it in, and there, hey, which one's more of a miracle? I mean, you can say they're both miracles, but I mean, to me, one is not any less of a miracle than the other. And do we have any precedent to think it might have been one over the other?
Well, I would say God caused a great fish to swallow Jonah. So, I mean, he caused that fish to be in that place at that time.
Yeah, when we talk about fish swallowing things, yeah, he did, and that really happened. When you think of all the miracles, what is the other miracle maybe most closely associated with this miracle where people weren't healed or fed or anything like that? Anything come to mind? I think the closest one I can think of is a wedding in Cana where Jesus did what?
Turned the water into wine.
Yeah, he turned the water into wine, which is really, you could say, big deal, they needed to drink some wine, you know. And there were more witnesses for that, you know, than just one. But what did Jesus use? He had them fill the water pots up with water. He used something organic and natural and then changed it into something useful and purposeful. And you could say, well, that was dirty water. If he would have just changed that into wine, people might have been disgusted. But they didn't know where it came from. But he had them fill the water pots, all of them, with clean water, and then he changed it to wine. How did God create Adam? Out of thin air?
It says from the dust.
From the dust of the earth. How did he create Eve?
From a rib.
From the rib of Adam. And it seems to me that after the initial creation, that God doesn't just make things appear out of nowhere. That he uses the resources available to achieve his will.
It shows that he's in control of the elements.
I really think that's the point, David. I mean, who is this that can have a fish, that's a spoonerism if you don't know what that is, a fish swallow a coin in some place in time, and then direct this fish's path through the ocean to this hook at the exact precise time that that Peter is fishing and just happened to have the exact amount of tax that was owed for him and Peter. Who then is this?
It, same thing when they were crossing over the Sea of Galilee in the storm, and then Jesus calms the storm, the wind and all, and they said, who is this man that has control over, you know, the wind and such a storm?
He has control over everything. That's what this miracle is, I believe. It's not that, and he could have made the point, and maybe he did make it miraculous, but I like the other explanation better, because I think that's how God works. That he uses what's available to him through providence, through circumstance, to make things happen according to his will. And that coin happened to be in that fish's mouth at that precise time for that specific purpose. And to me, it is just a complete emphasis on who Jesus is. And if he could know what was in this solitary fish's mouth at this particular time, what does he know about us?
Everything.
What does he know about the circumstances of our life? Everything that happens every day. Every second. What are we told in Matthew 20, 10, 29 through 30? Are not two sparrows sold for a cent, and yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered. A bird doesn't die without God knowing about it. Jesus knew exactly what he was doing and where this fish was. And, you know, as I was thinking about that, if we truly believe that God is alive and active in our lives today, we have to recognize that just like this coin in the fish's mouth, that he can use us in a particular place at a particular time to accomplish his purpose. And maybe we are where we are because God is trying to use us to do something. And I think when we talk about teaching people the gospel and the Bible, we have to recognize that that might be the case. That God may be putting me in this situation, and it may not even be a good situation for me. I may be in a hospital. Something bad may have happened, but God may be using that to put me in a situation where he can use me to glorify him, to teach others about him, to be that shining example that we are intended to be. Do you think that Jesus came across a woman at the well in Samaria by accident? That was just a coincidence? He just happened to be stopping there, and then this woman comes up? Do you think that was coincidence? Do you think Paul was at the river in Lystra, where Lydia and her household happened to be there washing clothes or singing hymns and praying by coincidence, by accident? No, he directed them. And we know about numerous places where it says Peter went to Cornelius, not by accident, because God told him to go there. Philip went to the eunuch. Why? Because God sent him there. But who's to say God is not putting these people in these places at these specific times for this specific purpose? And who's to say he's not doing that for you and me and for others? Do you think God cares about the soul of that woman at the well any more than he cares about the soul of Vince Constantino or Captain Pleasure? No. And if he's got people who are seeking truth out there, the Lord knows who are his, we're told, then maybe he's directing them to where they can hear it. Maybe he's putting us in a situation where if we will just seize it, we will have the opportunity to fulfill his purpose in our lives by saying something to somebody about God. I mean, If God is alive and real as we believe he is, then he can do that, and I believe he does do that, that he will put us in this situation. But we have to be looking for the opportunities, and we have to be willing to speak up.
Now, Rick, real quickly, you know, me and Les were talking before class started, we were just talking about, you know, situations that are happening in the world, in our country and all, and Les made the comment about, you know, it seems like no one's listening to us. I mean, the squeaky wheel gets the grease and it gets the attention. And you have these people out there, these troublemakers that are so loud and so well organized and all. But like I told Les, you know, that's where, you know, we have to be ourselves. We have to be true. We have to be faithful. And even in a quiet way, but if we're living how we should be living, somewhere, somebody's going to hear us. Someone's going to hear the gospel made for the first time in all of it. That's why you trust in God that He can use us, whatever the circumstances, whatever the situation might be.
Yeah, look at 1 Peter 2. I had this written down. I wanted to read a couple of passages. 1 Peter 2, 9. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. That's our purpose. That we are, those who have been called out of darkness, have been called out of sin, are now to proclaim Him, His excellence, His marvelous light. And I think that's a powerful passage to remember. That is our purpose. All right, we're getting close here. For whom did Jesus tell Peter to give this tax payment?
To the collector.
Yeah, to the collector. And to whom and yeah, I didn't read the whole question. No, that was actually the first part of the question, I think. For whom? No. For whom did Jesus tell Peter to give? For whom was the tax payment? Not to whom, but for whom. I'm sorry, Frank. You answered the question the way I was thinking it, but not the way I worded it. Good job reading my mind. Yeah, for Jesus and for Peter. That's why he gave the tax payment, for Jesus and Peter. Well, we already said it. Who was exempt from this tax? Jesus. But Peter was not exempt.
That's right.
No, he was not exempt. What about the other 11 disciples? Doesn't that seem kind of unfair that Jesus paid the tax for Peter, but not for the other 11? Any reasons? You know, there's a couple explanations to that. Can you think of any why he might not have paid for the other 11 disciples? Why didn't he go find, six staters? Well, it'd be six and a half with Jesus, I think, or seven. Any thoughts? I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is whose house is this, possibly? Peter's house. So it may just be that it was just Jesus and Peter were there, and they're collecting tax for that. There's one other explanation that Brent Duncan shared with me one time that I thought was interesting. Ken, did he ever share that with you?
Yes, he did.
What was it?
That they weren't old enough to be required to pay that tax.
And that's interesting, isn't it? It was only for those who were 20 years old and up. And Peter's the only one who's married, right? So it would stand to reason that Peter might be a little bit older than the other disciples. They may have all been younger than 20 years old. Now, I don't think we think of them that. It may not be the case, but that is one way to think of it. That these are young men. I mean, I think we think of them sometime in their 20s and maybe late 20s, early 30s or something. But I don't necessarily. They're fishing with their dad. Obviously Andrew's the younger brother. I think we see that in James. And so these may have all been very young men that weren't even, at this time, required to pay that tax. So I think that's an interesting thing to think about. Who provided the payment for this tax? The fish?
The fish did.
Now Jesus. So what's this tax for? And who's it paid to? It's for atonement. It's to release a soul from captivity. And Jesus paid that debt to the Lord for Peter. And he paid for all of us, didn't he? I mean, that's really what I think we see here. That's what this two-drachma tax, it was for the atonement, and Jesus paid it. And in this case, he just paid it for Peter, but who did he really pay? Ultimately, he paid it for all of us. Matthew 20:28. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. He paid the ransom for all of us who could not pay the debt ourselves. The debt we have is insurmountable. we can, you know, throw in our yearly payment on it. We can do some good works. We can do, but we're never gonna pay that debt off. We don't have the ability to do that. Only Jesus could do that. And it made me think what we're told in Galatians 3, 27 through 29 as we're closing. Did we already have one bell? Good. Second one's about to ring. Okay. Let's read. We'll close with Galatians 3, 27 through 29. Pay attention to the word of here. For you are all sons of God. Who's exempt from paying the tax? The sons. For you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourselves with Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free man. There is neither male nor female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise. And as sons of God, we are all exempt from paying the debt for our atonement. It has been paid by Jesus Christ, who was the promise to Abraham. He is the seed through which all the world shall be blessed. So we are sons of God, and we are exempt from the tax because of what Jesus did and because he paid the debt. And I think that it's just such a beautiful way. This little coin in this fish's mouth. I mean, I hope we don't look at this passage the same ever again because of understanding what this tax was and how it was paid and who paid it. I really appreciate your attention and your good comments. Thank you.